Dear wonderful listeners, if you're looking to define your brand's core message but aren't sure where to start, that's where Smart Beauty can help. We're offering a 90-minute deep dive into your brand to give you clear action points on your messaging and strategy to help you grow and scale, so that you can get noticed by customers, retailers, and investors, and start to see sales soar. And the cost of this deep dive is redeemable against any larger project you work with us on, so you get all of that insight and value with minimal risk. We're looking for a few new clients who are ready to see amazing results. Just email hello@smartbeautycreative.com to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Louise Whitbread, a respected beauty journalist who has taken her expertise to the next level by completing a certification in cosmetic science. Louise and I have crossed paths numerous times in the beauty journalism world over the years, and I've always admired her commitment to evidence-based reporting. What sets Louise apart is her dedication to understanding beauty at a deeper level. She's not just reporting on products, but truly comprehending how they're formulated, why they work, and when marketing claims don't match reality. She's written for the likes of The Independent, Stylist, and Vogue Business. In today's conversation, we'll explore what inspired Louise to pursue formal education in cosmetic science, discuss the rampant misinformation in beauty marketing, examine sustainability challenges facing the industry, and get her insights on exciting innovations and underserved markets. So if you're tired of beauty buzzwords and want the real science behind your skincare, makeup and hair care, you're in for a treat. Let's dive in. So hi, Louise, lovely to get you on the podcast. And obviously, like, we've worked together for, I think, a few years now. So yeah, I just really admire the fact that you've completed your cosmetic science certification. Can't get my words out this morning. So what inspired you to look into formulations at such a deep level and sort of aspects of product development alongside your journalism career? Like, how did all that start?
Thank you, Viola. It was actually a friend of mine called Lisa Payne, who is the head of beauty over at Stylers, who first told me back at the end of 2023 about this new course that the Society of Cosmetic Scientists were offering. And it's an introduction to cosmetic science course, and it's created by industry experts, cosmetic scientists, formulators, a few journalists as well. And it's for people that don't have a chemistry degree but want to have a better understanding of cosmetic science. I thought it would be really useful to get a better understanding into cosmetic ingredients in products, especially given that I write about formulas all the time. I do a lot of product testing. Product reviews are a really key part of what my work involves, along with my trend forecasting work. And I wanted to get a much better understanding of how ingredients work, why they work, why products are packaged the way they are, how brands are trying to align their product formulations that are both innovative but also solve consumer problems and meet changing consumer needs. And I thought it would just make me a better reporter, more analytical. And when I'm attending these brand launches or I'm trying out a product for the first time, I have a much better sort of base knowledge to go from to be able to say that's why that works, or this ingredient is great because of this. This isn't going to work if you have this type of skin, etc. So I just thought it'd give me much more sort of all-rounder background when I'm approaching my work.
No, that's incredible. And I think it shows a great sort of sense of responsibility that you have to your readers that, yeah, like I said, as a journalist myself, we're sent all this stuff and we're sort of sent press releases, and it's trying to kind of wade through the marketing stories and get to the actual facts of the situation. Do you feel like sort of more journalists should sort of maybe follow suit where that's concerned? Because there is kind of a lot of misinformation out there, and it can be hard to kind of work out what is sort of myth versus fact.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think, going back to what you said about responsibility, I do think influencers and journalists more so, but I do think there sometimes it's easy to get caught up in all these lovely new launches, and there's a great perks 100%. Of the job. I'll often try out treatments, which is lovely, and it is part of my job of testing that product. I can't write about a product I haven't tried, but it is my responsibility as a journalist to communicate clearly to customers and beauty consumers in an unbiased way and not be aligned with brands just because I like them or I've been gifted product.
Yeah.
help them decipher what is a very saturated market. And I think the course that the Society of Cosmetic Scientists offer, and they offer multiple courses of different sort of levels and abilities. And I think if you can do it, I would really recommend it. It's app-based. You can do it all from home. You can do it from your phone if you want to. It's a great one to fit into freelance life like mine, if you're in-house. But I do think one thing it has been really helpful is when I now go to launches and I'm looking at ingredients and things, I'm able to call out the bullshit from beauty brands, excuse my language. There is so much of it, and you are bombarded by brands saying, our product is the best, this ingredient is the best. And yeah, I can better decipher, like, yes, that is, or actually, there's no actual scientific evidence or clinical evidence proving what you're saying. And it's all very well and good to say, our £100 moisturizer is amazing, but consumers need it. Does it actually follow through on what it's saying? Does it follow through on its performance claims, or is it just like clever marketing? And I think deciphering between the two and finding sort of the line in the middle of what's true is a really important job as a journalist. So I would highly recommend it to other journalists. And I think it's a great way to sort of improve your knowledge because the industry is always changing. And I think your skill set and your knowledge should also evolve with it.
100%. And it's kind of what we're trying to do here at Smart Beauty is getting rid of, as you say, the bullshit behind beauty marketing. Because I feel like the world of formulations, it's kind of there's a lot of gatekeeping and it's kind of this sort of, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, isn't there? Do you think it's very useful for like on entrepreneurs to kind of take courses like this, even if you might not have a scientific background? Do you think it's good for brand founders? Because a lot of the time they have a formulator and they kind of defer to them, and it feels like there's a bit of a disconnect there. Like, these are your product, this is your range. You should know exactly what is going into them, into these products, and how everything works.
Absolutely. And part of the on the Society of Cosmetic Science website, when I was looking into this course, they list people that would be suitable for doing the course. And like I said, it's for people without a chemistry degree, but they said brand founders could benefit from this, journalists, people that are just beauty enthusiasts can access it. But I think as a brand founder, if you don't have formal cosmetic science training or a background in cosmetic science, tools like this are a fantastic way to be more educated and then be able to better communicate to a consumer. I think if you are founding a brand, you should know absolutely as much as possible about that brand. You don't need to be a cosmetic scientist to launch a brand, but you should be able to tell a journalist like me or you about what's in the formula, why you've decided to use the ingredients you have, why you can justify the price point, what decisions have you made about the packaging, what markets you want to sell in. For example, the regulatory framework for the UK is different to Japan, which is different to the US. If you're planning to expand in those areas, you can't just have a nice marketing campaign with great imagery, great TikTok content. You need to have an understanding of what consumer need are we meeting? What is this useful for if there's already a sea of products that essentially, there is something for everyone out there. What makes you different? And I think having that credibility to be able to talk about your products and your brand in a way that's thorough, that shows you're educated and informed, is only going to strengthen your brand. Always referring to your cosmetic scientist or your product formulators, I think, can be a bit of a weakness. You should be, as a team, you should all be working together. I know no one is expecting sort of the CEO of a company to have the same amount of knowledge as, say, the scientists in the lab creating the product. But you should know that. And that also comes into sort of, do you know where you're sourcing your ingredients from? You're sustainable or trying to be a sustainable brand. Can you explain to people, industry insiders and your consumers and potential consumers, how sustainable is your product? Where are you getting your ingredients from? If they're lab-based, how are they more effective than what's derived from, say, plants, for example? And how are you understanding the changing beauty market to appeal to consumer needs? So I think I would really recommend it to a brand founder if they don't have that formal training already.
Definitely. And I think, like you say, sustainability kind of feeds into it. And I think the lack of knowledge kind of contributes to this kind of binary approach, like natural's good, synthetic's bad, when actually the reality is a lot different. I mean, I love a natural beauty range, but I love some cool technology as well. So you think that sort of these kinds of, the more that this kind of information is available, the more that the conversation will be sort of less black and white, and there'll be less kind of, scaremongering basically when it comes to sustainability. Like, brands can tell a more authentic story, and people can buy into it as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with the sustainability thing you're saying about the like sort of the natural clean beauty movement, things like the clean beauty movement is often propelled by brands themselves. And a lot of it, when from doing this course and before from my own research and my years of reporting, sometimes I'll see brands marketing and their language and the copy they use is not correct. It's scientifically it's not correct. And they might be saying things like, oh, natural is better. But there's no evidence of that. And then you have things like the clean beauty movement, where there's an implication that other brands that aren't considered clean are dirty, which also does a disservice to how strict it is to bring a product to market and it be allowed to be sold on shop shelves. That is not a week or short journey. There are so many tests you have to go through. There are so many things cosmetic scientists and product developers and packaging and all of that have to be taken into consideration. It's months, if not years. It's why you often hear brands say, this took us 4 or 5 years to formulate to get the right
Yeah,
one.
for
And
sure.
that's not just to say we wanted to get the perfect consistency, texture, finish. We wanted the best consumer trial results. That's an important part of it. But also because what you can sell in the UK is different to what you can sell in the US. It's the same with like Korea and Japan. With Korea, for example, we know there's lots of lovely, sophisticated, beautiful SPF formulas that aren't allowed to be sold in the US. So US consumers don't have that access, but the FDA in the US play an important role in making sure like what they feel is best for their market and their region. So I think it's very easy for brands, if they're not educated enough, and I think founders have a lot of responsibility to be educated, that you could end up being part of that misinformation sort of cycle. And you don't want to be associated as a brand that doesn't actually know what you're talking about, as we know
100%.
science develops. And I think if you're a brand, you shouldn't attach yourself too closely to things like that unless you have the ability to back it up and explain yourself thoroughly and work within the beauty industry to be consistent, to be thorough, to be meeting all these sort of expectations of consumer needs, but also behind the scenes of formulating needs and the requirements that are needed in the market.
Definitely. And I think there's a lot of demonizing of certain ingredients. So sort of silicones, for example, like not all silicones are the same. So yeah, you can get some quote unquote bad silicones that might sort of have all these kind of qualities that people are attributing to them. But then you get sort of good kinds of silicones that don't weigh down the hair and things like that and suffocate your skin. So I feel like yeah, that people had sort of t assume that ingredients, there's only kind of one, it's one size fits all approach, which I think is yeah, really damaging, I think. And it also kind of it pressures people to spend money that they don't have, which I think there's an ethical reason as well. Like, you can buy a drugstore shampoo that might have silicones in it. It's not, or conditioner that might have silicones in it. It's not gonna wreck your hair necessarily, as the way that these kind of more premium brands are making out. So I feel like there's kind of that dishonesty element. And then also I was gonna say parabens. Obviously, there's loads of conversations happening around that. But what these brands fail to mention is that preservatives like parabens are just so crucial. Otherwise, the product would go moldy, which is even worse than,
And they were a huge scientific breakthrough in the 40s when we discovered them and found out a way to use them. And they have such an important role in preventing mold growing on your moisturizer. If you think of like a tub of moisturizer, you're opening it, you're exposing it to the air, and then you
Dipping your
are
fingers
putting
in
your
it.
fingers in and out of it. And I think the Business of Fashion a few years ago did a really great article on how beauty has a mold problem. And it looked at brands like Kosas and things like that, where consumers were documenting on TikTok and Instagram how they were seeing mold in their products. And a lot of that was because they're these clean beauty brands that don't use preservatives and demonize them, like you say. But actually, if you're not using sort of traditional preservatives, what are you doing to preserve the product? Because that's really important too. And that affects like the shelf life of your product, it affects the color of your product, it affects how long you can use it for. And I think we often, I think the word toxic is also thrown about far too much. I think it's used to say about the smallest things are toxic or carcinogenic or things like that. And you see a lot in the supplement side of things about how certain supplements will flush out the toxins in your body. And I think, well, that's literally the function of the kidneys. Your body is designed to flush out actual toxins. Your foundation or your moisturizer is not going to be toxic. It has so many strict rules before it can be allowed onto shop shelves to ensure that they are
Exactly.
safe for consumers. And I think it's almost insulting if you're a brand to say, we don't use these ingredients because they're toxic. And I think often when we talk about toxicity, you very rarely hear it referred to as dosage, which go hand in hand. So your foundation is not safe. If you drank your foundation and you drank the whole 30 ml bottle, it'd make you
Yeah.
very unwell because it's not an ingestible product. But that doesn't mean it's not safe to put on your skin
For
in a
sure.
secret way.
Yeah, I mean, water can be toxic if you drink too much of it. You can kill yourself. So, there's a lot to be said for just having some kind of restraint when sort of making these claims, because like you say, some of them are just so outlandish. I mean, what are some of the biggest kind of misconceptions you've come across when it comes to kind of clean beauty and natural ingredients, now that you've got that sort of like knowledge and you've sort of done those sort of in-depth studies into the way products are formulated?
I do think clean beauty has like a lot to answer for in how it has peddled misinformation in the industry. And I think really, when we look at it, when brands refer to themselves as clean, they're implying that other brands that aren't as clean as them are dirty. And it goes back to that, like, you can't just put any product on the shelves and sell it to a customer. There are so many things that go into making a product or formulating. And part of the problem is that it's very difficult as a brand to communicate that to consumers because you don't have that much time to grab a consumer's attention. You
No.
might have a few seconds on a TikTok, you might have a minute on an Instagram, and that's not enough to go through all the steps you as a brand are taking to formulate products that are safe, but
No.
also how the industry works and how you can't have just unsafe products. It's why you don't see sort of, you only ever see things like handmade soaps and sort of handmade lip balms, things like that at like market stalls and things. You're not seeing them on the shelves at Boots. Because
Yeah.
they've not been tested. You could make a lovely soap in your kitchen sink, but that doesn't mean it's a great product. And I think one of the big misconceptions is that clean or natural equals product efficacy, and it doesn't. It doesn't speak to brand's performance, a product's performance. And I think one of the biggest problems with marketing claims and a lot of work that you've been doing with Smart Beauty is the language that we use with consumers. Sometimes that's the only. That's the first introduction or the entryway for consumers to your brand. And if that is not up to scratch, if that is not clear and accurate, it can still be fun and interesting and engaging. But if you are not coming at it with a great basis in fact, you could be misleading customers and then you're encouraging them to use products they don't need, or you're suggesting that they need this product when in fact, not every product is for everyone. Not every product should be for everyone. There's a reason we have like different needs for our skin and why an oily skin might not react well to shea butter in the way that a dry skin
Yeah,
could.
no, for sure. I mean, I don't know if you, this is a bit of an extreme example, but I don't know if you saw the Netflix series Apple Cider Vinegar that's been on about the this sort of bogus sort of wellness influencer, but it sort of made a point in general about how the kind of how toxic this kind of wellness conversation has got, that people were drinking juice instead of going to doctors for their cancer. And that one of the other influencers, she was genuine, but unfortunately, and it was based on a true story, she sadly lost her life because she went on this juicing cleanse instead of getting the medical help that she needed. Obviously, that's a very extreme example to the beauty
Yeah.
industry, but I feel like there's kind of parallels that you can draw from that when talking about natural versus synthetic. And then there's the world of green chemistry that I think not enough people are paying attention to, that, you know, science does have its place, and lab-grown ingredients, as long as they're safe and sustainable, you know, should be totally be talked about and included in the conversation, as opposed to just we just need to use essential oils and that's it. That's kind
Yeah,
of
but then there's a lot of essential oils that are not good for you.
100%. Yeah,
And
they're
also,
allergens.
I think it's easy to say where if a product grows out of the ground, it's good for you because it's plant derived and it's vegan. And you're like, well, actually, there's a lot more involved with that. So, like, or things like if you ingest too much some essential oils can be really dangerous for you, or you shouldn't use. Like, I think, isn't it correct that if you're pregnant, there are some essential
Yeah,
oils?
when I was pregnant, I actually had an aromatherapy client and I couldn't use any of the products because because it wasn't suitable for me. So yes, 100%. It's
That's another example of how clever marketing copy has been used to peddle misinformation. Essential oils suggest that they're like, you need them, you only need them, you don't need anything else. But we also know that there are some amazing, good quality, high performing ingredients like retinol, which has been very widely tested, very widely studied, very widely agreed that it is the gold standard of anti-aging. If you're looking for acne, help with acne scarring, retinol is a great one. Vitamin C is fantastic, brightening. But we also know vitamin C is a very volatile ingredient. You can't, not every vitamin C is going to work for you. And there's so many different ways to create a formula using vitamin C. And I think it's confusing enough for consumers to navigate an oversaturated market, but it's a real job responsibility of the brands to make sure what they're saying is not only solving a consumer problem, but is also accurate. And yeah, sometimes I don't think that's an unreasonable expectation.
No, definitely. And isn't retinol like pretty much the only clinically proven ingredient when it comes to and for like improving, the appearance of your skin and doing actually what it says, as opposed to the more anecdotal evidence that surrounds other ingredients?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the biggest things with retinol is it demonstrates how important education is from brands. You need to be educating customers on how to correctly use retinol, retinaldehyde, retinoic acid, whichever form you use it in. You cannot just go straight in and use the strongest version. You cannot, if you've never used retinol before, use it every day. We know there's going to be some minimal, at best, irritation. We know it makes you more susceptible to sun damage, so you need to make sure you're using sun cream. And I think brands need to be speaking to their consumers and potential consumers with that in mind, that you need to educate your customers on your products. You cannot just say, this is great, this is amazing, this works for everyone, please buy it.
Because there's been an outbreak of skin sensitivity, hasn't there? Because I think people are using so many abrasive treatments and not really understanding how to use them. Like with the introduction of acid toners, for example, and these ingredient-led serums that you're designed to kind of mix and match and be your own kind of formulator in a way. And as a result, I think people are kind of stripping away the skin barrier, and now they're dealing with sensitivity. Do you think we're kind of moving away from that now, and that more brands are sort of taking more responsibility?
I think so. And I think like a few years ago, I remember during the COVID pandemic and just before, exfoliating with acids was so aggressively pushed by brands. And now those same brands are focused on skin barrier repairing products, counteract the damage done by over exfoliating. And I do think I definitely agree with what you said about brands, say like The Ordinary or The Inkey List, who very much rely on the ingredient names to form the product names. And I think that does encourage people to play chemist.
For
And I
sure.
think sometimes you can get into a lot of trouble there because people want to feel like they're getting the most out of their products, but they also, I think sometimes there's a fun element of mixing and matching. But if you don't have that basis of education as a consumer, which I don't think there should be, I don't think the onus should be on the consumer. I think it should be on the brands to educate rather than
Completely
consumers to
agree.
themselves. And I think it's very easy to use products that can counteract each other. For example, like retinol and vitamin C, you shouldn't use that in the same routine. You should use retinol in the evening. Vitamin C is much better off using in the morning.
No, it
Because
makes complete sense.
vitamin C protects and brightens. Retinol is a treatment, which is great for if it gives you any irritation. That's much safer to use in the evening because it's not going to disrupt how your makeup sits, or you have a bit more time to for it to absorb before you apply the rest of your products. But I definitely agree with what you said about it does encourage you to play chemist, and I think that's where you can run into problems. And then I do think it's ironic now that brands that encourage like the use of acid toners and sort of everyday exfoliation are now pushing products which treat those
Trying
issues.
to reverse the effects that they
And
cause with their products.
yeah, and sometimes it's the slightly frustrating side of the beauty industry is you see brands sort of create a problem and then sell the solution, which is not exclusive to beauty. We see that across lots of industries. But I think it's why education is key, because if you're over exfoliating, that can lead to a whole wealth of issues. You could have a much more increased sensitivity. You could end up needing like help from a dermatologist, which we know are hard to access. There are long, huge waiting lines for the NHS. You could wait 2 years for a dermatologist. We also know that private dermatologists are very expensive. So you can really do a lot of damage to your skin with topical products if you use them in the wrong way.
Definitely. And then you said that earlier how brands don't have much time to kind of communicate these things to the consumer. So what do you think the solution
is, if there is one, because there is that problem of they're trying to get people's attention, but also they need to give them all the facts.
Exactly, yeah. I think so. For example, I think a couple brands have done this really well. Bioma, for example, on its packaging, it lists the sort of core ingredients in the Inkey list. And the main one, and the in an Inkey list, the ingredients you see listed on the packaging are any ingredients over 1% within the formula. And they will say things like hyaluronic acid is hydrating, shea butter is a conditioning agent. Another ingredient might be a thickener to make the product more viscous. And that's a really, and then they also have a list of steps of where this product sits in your routine. Is it for cleansing? Is it for toning? Is it for moisturizing? Or is it for protecting? Protect meaning SPF. And that's a really good way, as if you're the customer looking at the product, you immediately get all this information that you can read. And the same thing with the Inkey list. On the interior of their packaging, they break down the ingredients in the product, why they work, who they're for, who they will work for, and who they will not work for. And small steps like that, where you can really utilize your product packaging as an education tool for your consumers, I think is a fantastic way of doing it. But then I also think brands like Skinrocks, for example, Caroline Hirons, we know, has been in the skincare industry for years and years. She uses her TikTok and Instagram, and the brand's social media strategy is very much has her front and center. So when she launches a product, she is front and center explaining why she's created it, why she thinks it's worth it, how to apply it, package the deep dive on why they've packaged it the way they have. And I think that's a great way, because as a consumer, you feel like you have this direct access to a brand founder who knows their stuff. And whether or not you like Caroline Hirons or not, or Skinrocks appeals to you or not, you're still a bit more informed about the brand than you are if you didn't have that. And I think that's a great way of utilizing sort of a public figure founder, or like Bioma and Inkey list, utilizing your packaging to as a tool for education.
Yeah, those are some really great examples. And I think with a lot of brand founders, there is that pressure to kind of be the face or ambassador of your brand, as opposed to just a figurehead. So I think having kind of that kind of certification and knowledge and doing those kinds of studies that you've done, I think is vital in that respect when you're creating content for your customers and saying, well, actually, this is this is the real deal. Like, I actually do know what goes in my products and how they work. Just to sort of create that sort of level of reassurance that I think a lot of customers nowadays need.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think if you're, you don't, I think if you're, say, someone like Caroline Hirons, her being so visible and present and feeling accessible to people, she responds to people in the comments, for example. You can get direct feedback from her. She does lots of Q&As, so you can ask her direct questions. Things like that make you feel like, one, as a consumer, you're being listened to, but also this person knows what they're talking about, or is an expert in a certain area of skincare, and cares about the consumer. He doesn't just feel like a CEO trying to make a quick buck off
No.
only market, which I also think is very important.
No, and I'm a huge fan of Caroline. I think it's her professional reputation that's on the line as well. So she wouldn't put her name to anything that I think would not match up with what she would, with industry standards and what people expect, that level of transparency that people have come to expect from her. What ingredients and formulations are you most excited about in your going looking at your kind of job as a trend forecaster? What's really kind of jumped out at you in the last few months, and what do you think is set to be big?
I think biotech in beauty is a really interesting area, and it's a big area of innovation. It's new and exciting. There's a brand called Rheome, which was created by
Lovely.
a former beauty journalist, Joanna Elner. And she has studied a lot in Chinese medicine after leaving journalism, and has now created this like beautiful brand. It's a small curated line. There's a cleanser, a skin broth serum, an eye cream, and flannels, which are fantastic flannels, by the way. But
Good
she has
flannel.
worked with a company called Daybue, which is a biotech lab backed by L'Oreal. And they have utilized in their new eye cream this ingredient, which is the first to market, first of its kind, called DHK3. And it's a triple hydroxyflavonoid derived from plants. And they've basically isolated it in its most potent form and used it in the eye cream to create this really beautiful balmy gel formula, which is great for skin barrier repair, which we were talking about before. And it's a really interesting use of biotech in a luxurious but accessible way. You can see it in store in Liberty, and you can buy it online. But it's sort of, if you buy the eye cream, you are able to access this amazing wealth of research, which has been years in the making, to work out DHK3, which is a really high performing ingredient that's better than sort of your average of basic hyaluronic acid, for example, which is an effective ingredient, but also has been around a very long time and is not the be all and end all of hydration. There's lots of other ways you can hydrate your skin.
Yeah,
And
and I've heard it can actually dehydrate your skin as well if you don't
yeah,
use
exactly.
it.
Again, it goes back to the education. Like, consumers don't realize if you're using it in a very dry environment, your hyaluronic acid serum is not going to be as effective as if it's in a moist environment, which is why you often hear it recommended to dampen your skin first. So little things like that. And I think speaking to the CEO of Daybue at the eye creams launch a few weeks ago, his name's Joshua, he was saying how there are so many ways that this technology can be used. And I asked, is it possible to use this sort of technology to create a budget product? Because Riom is a beautiful luxury brand, but it is luxury, so the price point is not going to appeal to everyone. And he said, yep, there's so many ways you can use it to make your ingredients more effective. You can make the sourcing of ingredients a much more lab-based. You're not actually pulling the plant from the ground, so there is a sustainability benefit there as well. And I think that's quite exciting because it makes biotech sounds really almost like dystopian and
Stage.
futuristic, but it can actually be quite accessible within beauty, and I think that's quite interesting. I also think there are the use of AI is quite exciting. For example, last year I spent months working on a report for stylists about AI and beauty and how it's pioneering innovation. And there's a company I spoke to called the Good Face Project, and the CEO Ivar spent we spent hours talking about its AI machine, which it calls Cara, and it works alongside cosmetic scientists and product developers to help them streamline processes within the business. For example, if you're a business with a sustainability manifesto that by 2030 you want to get rid of a certain list of ingredients to be more sustainable,
Yeah.
the Good Face Project uses its AI to help product developers and cosmetic scientists skim through scientific papers and read through research on ingredients and pull together in minutes ingredients that will work just as well. Can make sure they hit the manifesto without a team of cosmetic scientists having to sit in a room and read through
It's through
scientific
everything.
paper. And it can do it in, I think it's 13 minutes instead of what could be months and months of work. And obviously, you still need a human involvement. You still need that human eyes on it. And you need the expertise of cosmetic scientists. But tools like that can be really helpful in discovering new and exciting ingredients that we might not know about yet, but in a couple of years' time could be in a lot of the serums we're using, in moisturizers we're using, in cleansers. So I think there's lots of room for exciting innovation. And while I think it's good to have a healthy skepticism towards AI, and I don't think it should be used to replace humans at all,
No, it's I
but
see it as
the
like a
way that the world
powerful
is now.
assistant.
Exactly, yeah. And that can be a really useful tool for cosmetic formulating.
Definitely, especially in terms of sustainability as well, because I think it can, help kind of move the needle and make, the industry as a whole a bit more sustainable, without, like you say, people having to sift through, thousands of research papers in order to find those kind of perfect ingredients. And going back to biotech, I think that that's kind of a lovely example of how the sort of natural world and then also science and technology can be utilized in tandem rather than just saying, well, just use natural products and, but that, they're because I think it shows that how technology is kind of influencing the beauty industry, but in the sense that these ingredients are just not just effective, but also safe and sustainable.
Yeah, and when we talk about sustainability, I think sometimes we think about like, oh, recyclable packaging or plastic free. But within the sustainability conversation is also the welfare of the workers who might be who you're sourcing your ingredients from. For example, shea butter. We know a lot of African countries create that and it's grown there. Are those workers being looked after? Are they being paid fairly? Is there a transparent supply chain? And I think there's loads of different methods and approaches of being sustainable that is not just ingredient led.
No.
Ingredients are not just, we use this plant derived ingredient. It's who is picking that ingredient. If we're taking it from the ground, are we replacing it? Is it replenishing? Is it renewable? Or sometimes in a lab, it's actually more sustainable because you're not taking from the environment, you're
Yeah.
creating nothing.
You're not disrupting biodiversity with aggressive farming and causing deforestation, for example.
Exactly. And the haircare brand Davina's does an excellent job at that. They are based in Italy and they are family run, but they do a lot of work within regenerative farming. So they spend a lot of time educating their farmers on how their ingredients that they're picking from their farms and grown on their farms are used, how they can use more renewable sources, how they can create a better environment for these to grow. The farmers are well looked after. On the bottle of every product you say, it will tell you which farm it was created on and whose farm it is. And that's a great way
Exactly.
of keeping transparent about the ingredients, but while also trying to be sustainable, eco-friendly, and making real changes rather than just saying, we're cutting out all plastic. Because there's lots of plastic alternatives, like glass, for example. And you see, I think sustainability is an area where there's lots of problematic language and the way
Oh,
it's
definitely.
marketed, it
They
can
say
sound
like recycled
great.
plastic. Well, that doesn't sort of solve the problem. It doesn't close the
Yeah,
loop because,
exactly.
yeah, it's not, it can't be kind of quote unquote perfectly recycled, can it? Because you still need kind of more plastic to keep the thing going, if that
Exactly.
makes
Well, you
sense.
see sort of products that say they're recyclable, but the lid is not.
No.
Pump, for example, on sort of pump products like cleansers, very difficult. Sometimes they're sealed on, you can't separate them to recycle the bottle. Sometimes you can't recycle the pump at all because it has too much plastic in it that can't be, that's not biodegradable,
Exactly.
for example. It's a very sort of, it can get very messy, and there are so many different ways to be sustainable beyond just recycling a bottle.
And on that note, what do you think about certification? So, sort of governing bodies like B Corp certification, for example, because there's been a lot of chatter I've noticed recently about the sort of integrity of some of these companies, especially because they stand to make a profit. I mean, they're businesses basically. So when somebody sort of, gets certified, they have to pay, companies need to pay to be certified. So it's in their interests
Yeah, exactly.
to sort of give out this certification. I mean, have you kind of, do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think it's still a good idea for brands to be kind of certified by a specific governing body?
Yes and no. I think, for example, B Corp, I know they have quite a rigorous examination criteria before they award B Corp, but I also think, like we were saying, there's different levels of sustainability. So you can be, say, you're a sustainable brand, but do the absolute bare minimum and try and use a less wasteful form of plastic, but you're still using plastic.
Yeah,
And I think those
don't care if
accreditations,
it's recyclable.
yeah,
You still use
exactly. And I think, like you said, you can be associated with these, which can help because then consumers then recognize it. And as these companies build their profile, B Corp is now a much bigger and more widely understood by consumers than it was, say, 4 years ago. But I also think there's lots of fantastic brands doing great work who are small, for example, they can't afford to
Yeah.
pay for accreditations. And so that does also cut them out of the conversation. And you think that there is a hard line to toe between, well, the companies such as B Corp need to make money to continue with research and their marketing and putting out that this is how they examine products and this is how they award brands. But then you've got smaller brands at the end of the scale who can't access that accreditation, which could help them put them on the map more. So I think it can be quite a tricky line to toe for brands.
Yeah, for sure. And with the studies that you undertook, obviously it sort of encompassed so many different categories in the beauty industry, so from like skincare and oral care. Do you think there are any kind of overlooked categories or sort of gaps in the market that you think have huge innovation potential at the moment?
I think one overlooked market is the mature beauty consumer.
Hmm.
I think there are some brands doing fantastic work. For example, Sarah Creel, who's the former CEO of Victoria Beckham Beauty, she left in 2022 to launch her own brand, Sarah Creel, in the US. It's not available in the UK yet, annoyingly, but it is for a 40 plus consumer, and it is focused on making products for an older consumer with older skin needs who doesn't want a full coverage foundation, wants something lighter, but wants something hydrating enough in their foundation, for example, to not sink into fine lines. And then we've seen sort of Skin Rocks doing a great job with that, Westman Atelier as well. And I think often Gen Z and Gen Alpha, I guess, is the next one.
Yeah.
It's such a big focus for brands that I think older consumers get forgotten about, who often have more money to spend on brands, but are more fussy with what they want and more willing to spend on luxury. And I think one thing I would love to see within that, from brands overall, is if you're launching a product that's got an anti-aging focus, use someone with fine lines and wrinkles in your marketing campaigns.
Yeah.
Don't use a 21-year-old model just to sell us advanced night repair from Estée Lauder, for example, which is a fantastic product, but it is for older skin.
No, if I see an airbrushed 20-year-old staring out at me, that's not going to tell me anything about
It's
what the
not
product
appealing
can
at all.
do.
And then also you've got things like if you are launching a spot product or a breakout product for acne-prone skin, show people with breakouts. Show people with acne in your product imagery. Don't just show someone with perfect skin, because that's someone with acne. If I see that, that doesn't tell me anything about your product's performance. I think it's these older brands speaking to an older consumer really well, like Sarah Creel, that are doing a really great job at sort of capitalizing on that underserved area of the market, but there's still a huge demand for product. There's lots of people, men, women, everyone in between, who are willing to spend on products if they work for them, rather than sort of the way Gen Z approaches things, where it's lots of like trying and testing and mixing and matching and using four different products for their lip color.
Exactly.
I think there's a lot of room there. I also think something I'm seeing recently is more expansion within the hard water, solving the hard water issue. So we know in London and Oxford, for example, and especially the south of England, hard water is much worse than it is in other parts of the country. And hard water has an effect on your hair health. It's not just your lime scale in your bathroom and the water pressure. We know it can be very drying for hair. We know it can affect how well your color lasts if you get color treatments. Like I, for example, get highlights. I find color doesn't last in my hair as well. And when I've spoken to my hairdresser, she said she's from New Zealand. She said in New Zealand and Australia, because of the difference in the water pressure and how they have softer water, you can get a much better color that will last a lot longer. And that's partly just environmental, but there's also now brands launching products to counteract that, like Hello Clean, and people like that, and Actinacre, that have these hard water focused products. And I think that's solving a consumer need that's only going to become more prevalent. And I think we're all about trying to get our hair to look as good as possible and using masks and treatments. But if the water you're washing your hair under is causing damage to your hair,
Exactly. It's undoing all of that good work and
exactly. And no amount of hair mask is going to fix that. But there's things like shower head filters, which I'm testing at the minute. They're a great way to sort of counteract that. And they are partly wellness. They're going to improve your shower experience. We need to shower every day. They're an easy day-to-day product, but they can still be sort of really innovative with their technology. And then you've also got like shampoos and treatments and things like that to counteract hard water damage. So I think that's quite an interesting category. And then lastly, I would say sort of makeup packaging. I think Danessa Myricks, I would say, is at the forefront of this. Last year, she launched a Groundworks palette, which is a large eyeshadow and complexion palette, but the pans are magnetic and removable. And you can condense it down to a smaller palette using these cleverly attached magnetic panels within the eyeshadow palette. So you can take a 8-shade palette and create it into two or four that you can put in your handbag, and you've got your whole makeup
that's
routine in
really
your
good.
handbag. Things like that, like packaging, I think is a really key area where we can see a lot of innovation, and it's sort of the first thing you see as a customer, and it can be the first thing that gets you interested. So I think I'd like to see more things like that, because we talk a lot about makeup on the go, but I think realistically, I'm not putting foundation on the go. I'm not applying
No.
mascara on the go. I'm applying lip balm. I might bring a powder to touch up.
Exactly. No, I'm all about packaging. Like, packaging is a big part of the decision-making process for me, I have to say, not just about the product. Obviously, I want the product to work and to be good, but yeah, some nice packaging that it's kind of like a status symbol, isn't it?
And packaging, like the course I did with the Society of Cosmetic Scientists, they cover packaging very in depth within it, because packaging is so key to how a product performs. If a product is too viscous, it can't be in a tube. It needs to be in a tub that you can put your hand into and scoop out product. If you have a thinner, watery-based product, a tube is probably better, or a pump where you can control the dosage. And how a product performs also is reliant on the packaging, not just the formula inside. I think sometimes that can be difficult. I don't think that's always communicated as well to consumers. It's sort of like, oh, this, I don't understand why it's like this, or why couldn't they have put it in a pot? I'd much rather it. But actually, it might not work as well. It might be a lot harder to use.
That's the thing.
It's a really important part when you're formulating a product, is what is it housed in, and how does that address a consumer need as much as the formula that's inside it?
And that's why I think more and more of us are going towards kind of water-free products, because sadly, if a product's got water in it, you need plastic because it's not going to then leak. As you know, there aren't many kind of non-plastic alternatives that can hold a water, a water-based, a liquid product as well.
Exactly.
So it could be just like not just changing the packaging, but the types of products that are being
Yeah,
put out there.
absolutely. Like Substract, there's a brand called Substract, which uses it's all like solid products, so it's free from water. And again, if you also have water, you need a preservative for the water.
Exactly.
So if you use a water-free product, that's another way you can cut out preservatives if that's a concern for you, while still getting an effective product and not demonizing effective preservatives that are required in water-based products. It's sort of a bit of a vicious cycle. But Substract do these amazing like solid cleansing balms in these wooden casing packaging. They're really beautiful, really lovely, and that's a great way of sort of being a bit more sustainable in your routine, but still getting all the benefits of a cleansing balm that effectively removes your makeup the same way it would if it was packaged in a plastic jar.
No, for sure. I just can't. I don't know about you. I just can't get on board with solid products. I don't know. As a consumer, I like a sort of a pump hand soap rather than like a bar of soap that's just going to go cakey and nasty on the corner of the sink. I mean, do
And
you
that's
have any
another
thoughts about
sort of
that?
like formulating problem is that if you are making a solid product, we know there needs to be more oils, more waxes to make it solid. And it's solidified and it's chilled and then it remains solid. But you also, like, I personally don't love using a solid bar of soap because it's messy, because you then you need to get a soap dish
And
and
it's
then
grubby and
all these dirty marks around it. And I find that as a con user experience, I don't find that as clean or as tidy or as neat.
it feels less hygienic, doesn't it, in a way, isn't it?
Exactly. Even though that's a good way to cut out, to use less water in your routine, we know it's a big issue within sustainability, not just within beauty at all, but it is sort of like sustainability is quite a tricky one because you also want to meet a user's needs. You want it to be a nice user experience, worthwhile to spend your money on, while also hitting all the sustainability criteria. So do think that's quite tricky for brands to get right.
Definitely, like a shampoo bar as well. That's fine if you've got kind of shoulder length fine hair, but for me, I have waist length textured hair. Like a shampoo bar is not going to do it. It's not going to cut it for me.
And I also think sustainability, particularly within haircare, is not as great as doesn't seem to be making as many strides within inclusivity as, say, like makeup does. Like a shampoo bar is not going to work if you have 4C afro hair.
That's the thing.
Or you might need a lot more. You need a lot more product. We know that sort of that hair type needs a lot more like conditioning and has a much more thorough washing process. I can just use any basic shampoo because I have Caucasian straight fine hair. And I'll probably be fine. But I don't think when it comes to sustainability, I don't think inclusivity is often as much of a focus as
No.
it is, like skincare and makeup.
No, that's a really good point, and I think that's something that I think a lot of people miss out in the sustainability conversation. What's the one piece of advice that you would give to beauty brand founders who want to become kind of more fluent in cosmetic science, if they don't have time to kind of undertake the sort of more formal training or do the sort of courses that you've taken? What would be sort of something that you would suggest they do in the meantime?
If they can't undertake formal training or they're unable to do like the SES courses that I did, there are so many other avenues where you can learn more about cosmetic science. For example, read, read, read. As a journalist, I have to read constantly to be up to date on what's happening. And there are so many resources like Cosmetics Business do an excellent coverage of ingredients with their Pure Beauty magazine. Websites like Glossy or The Industry or Beauty Independent do fantastic reporting on brands that are using emerging ingredients, emerging tools like AI, and how they're being used to source new ingredients, new packaging developments, etc. And I also think it's important to embrace the beauty community. For example, on TikTok, there's an American duo called The Lipstick Lesbians.
Oh, I follow them on Instagram. I'm obsessed with them.
Fantastic. And they have just launched Let's Learn Beauty. It's their own cosmetic science course and it's for anyone. So, a beauty enthusiast, a founder, an influencer, a journalist. And it covers why products are the way they are, how they're packaged, what it means, what you can expect from them, the difficulties in formulating those products. And there's loads of resources available. One thing I would say about the course I did is it's app-based, so I could do it anytime I wanted within a year. You could do it from your phone if you wanted.
That's
So
amazing.
it's a really great way to fit into a very busy lifestyle. I also think there's a brilliant podcast, like the Eco World podcast is fantastic. I think it's also well worth following cosmetic formulators on their social channels that have built a social following. For example, Dr. Michelle Wong from Lab Muffin or Jen Novakovic from the Eco Well, who are speaking to brands, to consumers who are helping make complicated science digestible. And I think that's a really great resource to sort of keep on your radar at all times.
No, I think it's so important given the amount of misinformation that's out there. Louise, thank you so much for joining me. It's been really lovely. I could chat about this all day with you, to be honest. We're like limited on time, but thank you so much for joining me. And yeah, hopefully have you back on at some stage again soon. But looking forward to reading some more of your reports and articles. I'll include your Instagram handles so people that want to follow you, they can keep up to date on sort of your latest reports and things like that. But yeah, thank you so much. It was lovely chatting with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.